Hey, gut thrivers. Welcome,
Good morning.
Welcome to our first quarterly webinar of 2021. This is super exciting. Just pulling up the chat. For those of you that don't know, I'm Nicole Duby. I'm the lead clinician at The Whole Journey. And I have a master's degree in nutrition. I'm a board certified state licensed dietitian nutritionist. And I've been in practice for about 8 years now. And I work with gut issues, autoimmunity, and I specialize in mast cell disorders and histamine intolerance. And as always, we're joined by the amazing Dr. Jack Tipps, who you all know and love, as do I. Jack is my spirit animal. So we're super happy to have him with us. How are you, Jack?
Hey, just doing great. Having a rainy morning in Texas, and those are always a great day. So,
yeah. All right. So, you know how we like to roll with the webinars. Tell us what's new and good. Put your questions in the chat and just tell us what's been going on with your health and your life right now. Tell us where you're joining from. Oh, so we have Jackie from the UK. Susan. Oh, hey, Vicky's here. Love Vicky. Heidi. Great.
Yeah, let's see who has a question, and I'm sure we'll have plenty to say.
For sure. So, before we jump into questions, though, I wanted to talk a little bit about SIBO. I know we have a lot of Plan Essers on the program, and I wanted to mention, and Jack, get your take on some exciting new research from Dr. Pimentel at Senior Sinai. He's one of the world's top SIBO experts. And he and his team have found that up to 70% of IBS cases are actually SIBO. And so they found that the other 30% were from things like narcotic use or surgical adhesions or something else. But that finding is huge for the field of intestinal health. And I think it gives us hope for those diagnosed with IBS, because a lot of times I think they just kind of send us home and tell us to just deal with it for the rest of your life. And for me, I don't know how you feel, Jack, but I've always kind of thought it was kind of a catch-all diagnosis when they couldn't find the root cause, for certain GI symptoms. But it's really similar to the story about peptic ulcers and H. pylori. We've known about peptic ulcers since the 80s, and then they discovered that H. pylori was the cause about 60 to 70% of them. So now anyone who gets a peptic ulcer, you're automatically checked for H. pylori. And I think that's kind of the direction we're heading now with SIBO and IBS. So if you present with IBS, you're probably going to get a SIBO test in the near future. So that's fantastic. But what I wanted to get your take on, Jack, was about the research and how they found that most of those IBS SIBO cases have an autoimmune origin, and that it actually started with a food poisoning event. And so I think a lot of times we don't realize that we have a food poisoning event, because we think it has to be this like really super catastrophic thing where you're violently vomiting for a day. And it can be that, but I think it can also be on a continuum. So like you could have diarrhea for 2 days like a year ago, and you don't know that's the reason why you have chronic IBS. So they related that food poisoning to bacteria like E. coli, Salmonella, Campylobacter. And then they found that those bacteria secrete something called cytolethal distending toxin, which creates an immune response in your body, which then causes your body to make antibodies. And so they found that those antibodies cross-react with a protein in the intestinal wall called vincelin. And that damages your migrating motor complex, which keeps your intestines clear of too much bacteria. And that's how they found that you can get that bacterial overgrowth in the small intestines. So what's your take on that, Jack? How do you feel about that research?
We just keep finding the order of disturbance. And we always have to keep asking, but why? I think that's one of the things we should learn from our 2 and 3 year olds. When they go, why are the stars in the sky, or, why? And when we keep asking this why, we keep tracing it back, then we can find the root cause. So right now, unfortunately, I think when people make these discoveries scientifically, this will arm, it's a good thing, it'll arm more doctors to give more antibiotics to treat the overgrowth that now is scientifically established. but we want to keep stepping back another step to find what's the cause. And so when we have these disturbances, we can just look at the autoimmune process. So the thing that's peaking here is that maybe a good portion of autoimmune processes are starting in the gut. See, we keep, science keeps driving us back to correct the gut. And then when we listen to Krista's message about finding food sensitivities that come from having SIBO, or find the lack of motility from the migrating motor complex that's now been interrupted, the gut, the brain gut connection, we start putting these pieces together. But there's probably 10 causes. And one, it could be as simple as for someone eating what we call in nutrition, a denatured food such as American wheat, where it's been hybridized and glyphosated to dry the crop before it's used, and all the things that are going on starts creating disturbances. Snacking will constantly be pulling stress on the digestive system. So eventually we get back to finding that we have a strategy to reprogram and to reestablish a proper gut. And but so much, as you know, Nicole, our gut is a major part of our immune system. So we really have to have gut integrity to have immune integrity. And if there's constant, we don't want to call it, it's not always a bad, wicked pathogen. You know, if we get the migration of probiotics through the ileocecal back up into the small intestines, and the immune system has to attack them, which it's the immune system's job is to keep the integrity of the small intestines, then that warfare starts to have side effects when the onslaught is too much. And then we all have learned the buzzwords. The bacteria get upset that they're being attacked, and they release lipopolysaccharides, which drive inflammation. As the body gets an overexcited inflammatory process going, that then can get the collateral damage of autoimmunity. And if you throw in something like commercial milk that's been pasteurized, homogenized, and homogenization just breaks the fat particles down so they get through the intestines before they're ready, and this type of thing, and we keep using these aggravating foods, then the immune system is having to deal with an improperly digested milk molecule or a leaky gut broccoli molecule or something, and then there's the collateral autoimmune response. So we really can start creating a cosmology here of the various causes, and backed now by science. So what we've been saying for 30 years based on logic in natural health, now science is starting to prove. And now we can collectively embrace this information and move forward. So for anyone in our audience who's having autoimmune concerns and chronic motility concerns and so forth, these are the things that Krista has pondered so much to develop this program. And now we have a way out and a way to get back to our optimal health. So you got me wound up there, Nicole, and I'm gonna zip it now. But that's sort of the broader picture, yeah. That with SIBO coming up, it may not be the classic, all the SIBO symptoms, they're just minor, but that overgrowth in the small intestine is going to keep hitting the immune system. You've got to stop this. You've got to control it. The bacteria get meaner. Now we have the zonulins opening up the gut. The immune system tries to go into the gut to deal with this. The leaky gut happens. The food allergies, food sensitivities, autoimmune disturbance come. So we've got this big, beautiful cosmology that goes, yeah, we need to look at the 10 factors that set people up for SIBO. And now we have a 10-week strategy, yeah, to start addressing the root cause, the foods, the motility, the snacking, the open ileocecals, right, all the things that come up with this, the damage from antibiotics that are in commercial meat that keep getting these bacteria to become more virulent. And then we suddenly find it's so disturbing that our friends, our friendly probiotics, can start being our enemies when they're in the wrong place and they're becoming invasive through the small intestinal lining. They're a flat out pathogen, but it's not the bacteria's fault. It's the individuals, the diet, the treatment, and so forth. But now we have a chance to back off from that. And it's just, it's always, you picked a good one there.
Yeah.
The PMID on that, which is the reference number on this research, yeah, is 311-52332, that people can go in and look at the study, yeah, and realize that science now is joining the natural health position, that we've got to work in the small intestine. And what you mentioned, Nicole, even higher up, because the disturbance might be starting with hydrochloric acid,
right,
in the stomach, the pepsin, the intrinsic factor. And we just go further up the pipe, like Krista does with the program, and start working it back down. And then a person can break through, not just saying, I killed SIBO with an antibiotic, now what? But no, they have a complete rejuvenation, and now their immune system can quiet down. And this is why this program is helping collaterally with things like thyroid issues or joint issues or skin issues, is because that chronic inflammation is going down, and the body can reset. So, wonderful stuff. Now, I bet you've got something to say on that research. So I'm going to pass the baton back to you and get us cranking.
Sure. And so I'll put a link to the study in the follow-up email we sent out tomorrow with the replay. So if you're interested, like Dak said, you can look it up and read about it. But one of the interesting things too is they included clinical guidelines for SIBO, and the six most important things they listed were hydrochloric acid, digestive enzyme, bile, motility, closing the ileocecal valve, the gut immune system. And again, that's just some wonderful validation for the work that we're doing here in this program. We're covering all of those things. So I think it's just a wonderful validation. So so it's really exciting stuff. So with that, you want to jump into some questions, Jack?
Well, Susan's starting off wondering, because she's taken the COVID, this would be the mRNA vaccine, that is this going to mess with her Plan H? And I don't really see the connection in messing with the Plan H. Everything, you're just doing a couple of things. The vaccine is teaching your cells to read one of the spiky little proteins on the COVID vaccine and launch an immune attack against that. So that's the acute side, or, you know, should you have exposure to the
Would you recommend that she add in something like Thuja or something to help detox the adjuvant out, or
We do in classical homeopathy and have done for over 200 years regarding vaccines, because it's part of a vaccine that they have to kind of hit the mule upside the head with a 2x4, meaning that they put poisonous adjuvants into the vaccines in order to shock the immune system and say, hey, come on, immune system, pay attention. This virus information did not come through normal processes. It didn't come through the nose and respiratory system where the body should be more prepared for it. It came in through the arm and the muscle. And so we have to shock the immune system to say, hey, pay attention to this strange invader. And that's how you get your immunity. So this is all part and parcel of the normal, natural vaccination process, and homeopaths for the last 200 years have been concerned about the mercury, the latex, the aluminum, the PEG, which is polyethylene glycol, that's used in the one that Susan has that can open up the blood-brain barrier. We don't want that opening of the blood-brain barrier and then having toxins that are in the body get up in the brain and cause brain inflammation. And so when we look at the constellation of side effects from this self-protecting vaccine theory, that there's things you can do. And in homeopathy, just like you said, Nicole, there's remedies. Let them be in the most important silica and Thuja that you mentioned. Thuja was more specific to the smallpox vaccine, but homeopaths often put all three remedies into like a liquid, mm-hmm. and then people dose those. The remedy only helps the body adapt effectively to the vaccine. So there's not a, some people think, oh, I want to cancel this, or it's bad, I'm going to cancel it. You want the good and you want to discard the bad. And that's what the remedy helps facilitate. So
how do you feel about the brand Energetics for homeopathics? Do you like them, not like them?
Oh, I think that's fine. They're a Southern company, and yeah, they're a combination homeopathic. So they're on the right side of the fence there to help the body.
A remedy called Backcord that has all those components you talked about. So that could be something that you add in for a little bit just to support your body to detox out those adjuvants, Susan. So I can put a link to that in the follow-up email for you.
Yeah, but as far as being on GT5 and getting the vaccine, the program's not going to make any inhibition to your vaccination process. And if anything, it can make you better prepared for it. So people in good health are going to handle the vaccines in better. And that's what you're doing there, Susan.
Hey, Vicky said she's doing well on her second round of GT5. She's taking the supplements at half doses. That's great. Yeah, it's totally fine. If you're sensitive or you're not tolerating full doses, it's fine to drop down to half or a quarter. Just find the level that works for you and go there, and you'll still get a lot of therapeutic benefit. Jackie says she's been having gallbladder spasms since week 3. It's been years since she's had them, which is worrying her a little bit. And she's hesitant to do a gallbladder flush because she overdid flushes many years ago and it made her gallbladder hypersensitive. How does Gut Thrive help and affect the gallbladder, and what can I do to support and reduce the pain? Yeah, I remember mentioning to Jackie to do some ultrafos drops, to do 10 drops 3 times a day for 3 days, and then do a little 3 tablespoons of olive oil, 3 tablespoons of lemon, then do a coffee enema the next morning and sort of have that release. But would there be anything else you would have her do, Jack?
Well, I think throughout the program, people should do exactly what you're saying, Nicole, is check in with you on these issues, because the squeaky wheel needs to get the grease, as the saying goes. And when something like this flares up, keep in mind the desiccated liver is extremely supportive of the gallbladder. Yeah. So by giving early support to the gallbladder, you're asking your body to be able to give a better quality of bile into the small intestine up high, where it can help with the SIBO process, because bile is a regulator of the small intestines, not just an emulsifier of fat. And both are needed, and that fat needs to get emulsified for the bacteria and so forth down the pipe. So the point there is a little nurture, a little support of the gallbladder, and then work your way on through the program, and you may well find that your gallbladder will emerge better than ever. I don't think a flush is necessarily called for, at least not without evidence of old bile or stone matter or soapstone or something in the gallbladder. Just keep gentle nourishment going and march along, and everything should, the weak links get brought along with the program.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's see. Tammy, if your gallbladder was removed, is it safe to do coffee enemas? As I heard, it gives a hiccup to the liver to produce bile, and I know gallbladder releases the right amount of bile to the small intestine to break down fat. But with the gallbladder gone, is it safe to produce more bile if not regulated? Jack, what say you?
Well, you know, the gallbladder is important to the terrain of the small intestine, because, like Tammy is saying, it releases on eating fats. When the gallbladder is removed, there's often an impaired ability to have fats that assimilate properly. And so a gallbladder cholecystectomy person should probably be supplementing with some lipase and some extra help, because the gut bacteria need to break down those fats that the bile is helping with. And then they're directly needed by the macula of the eye to prevent macular degeneration. Those fats are needed by cell membranes for energy and integrity. So there's a hitch in the giddy up for the gallbladder being gone. What happens is the liver will go on perpetual drip. So instead of having the bag or the reservoir called the gallbladder to store the bile and then release it into the small intestines on eating an avocado or something, it's just a constant drip, drip, drip that comes from the liver. And so you have a dearth of bile when you need it, but you also have bile when you don't need it. So once the gallbladder is out. So now we have to look at new processes. So we want to support the liver to make the bile. And if the coffee enema it'll jolt the liver to discharge a lot of stored up toxins. So this is hugely great. And then there is no gallbladder, so that bile goes into the small intestine and it helps with that ecology. So I'm going to give a thumbs up. See, if you know differently, Nicole, you know, now's the time. But I give a thumbs up to the coffee enemas to go ahead. The liver has more work now because it can't be on and off. And it does, as I said, the steady drip. And so we want to just support that and so that you keep your good fat digestion. And often people without gallbladders, they should be having the foods or the supplements that help with fat digestion, which your top one is considered the pancrelipase.
Yeah, I don't see a problem with having someone do it if they don't have a gallbladder. I've had clients use it successfully that way, and I think it's fine to do. Okay, next question is, Kelly, do you still recommend using sweeteners such as stevia and monk fruit? I heard Dr. Tom mention how these sweeteners affect the microbiome. We do on the program. The two that we recommend are dark stevia and monk fruit because they're low at glycemic index. And yeah, we still recommend them. I mean, we don't want you to go to town with these sweeteners, but those are the best alternatives to use, I think, while they're on the program. Jack, do you have any comment on the effect on the microbiome?
Well, sometimes, you know, I'm sitting here as kind of a Mr. Know-it-all, and then I get new information. And I'm wondering if Dr. Tom, who's brilliant, I'm wondering if he was really talking about the alcohol sugars first and foremost, the xylitol, maltitol, mannitol, and those kind of choke the microbiome. They are touted, particularly xylitol is touted as something that will interfere with the bad guys, and it's good. And I would say I wouldn't get all bent out of shape about it. A little bit probably of xylitol you're going to live over, but stevia is just all thumbs up in all the research that I've ever encountered. The stevia sweetness is a protein. You're not even getting sugar. So I'm not aware that the gut microbiome chokes on the stevia sweet protein. And you're going to get your carbohydrate from your vegetables and your, you know, your resistant starch. Krista's got that all worked out in the program. So stevia and monk fruit are great ways for sweets, because in our society today, we're eating 100 times more sugar, and that's just a number rounded off. But I think in 150 years ago, a person didn't even eat 1 pound of sugar in a year. Now we're eating like 250 pounds of sugar every year. And so we're trying to get back to a diet that doesn't just keep feeding the bad guys. Well, stevia doesn't do that. Monk fruit won't do it. Now, the people whose brains have a higher set point of sweet. Mm-hmm. For instance, my wife hasn't had sugars in years, and I'm a little more liberal. once in a while. My 20% rule is important to me, but she's very fastidious about avoiding the sugars. Well, I gave her a little tiny bit of apple juice that I'd made in almond milk with, and it was just like, oh my goodness, this is so sweet, I can't drink it. Her limbo bar, her set bar of sweets in the brain is way down, and her brain is making all the good energy and glucose and fats on a low sugar diet. But but the average person, their limbo bar is set way up because sugar's in all the grocery store foods practically. You know, every canned goods, you know, they're always going to have sugar. You can't, you know, barbecue sauce or any salad dressing, they all have added sugar. So the set bar is up. Mm-hmm. And so when we do this type of program, that set bar will come down. But Krista has to accommodate these people, because if you pull the rug out on that high set bar, your brain is going to cry, feed me sugar. I know I would kill for a bear claw. Or I've got to have a candy bar. And so this type of thing is going on. And if you can just go to a little stevia, you're getting the brain satisfied for the sweet tooth. And now you're not using sugar to keep reinforcing that. So it's an absolutely brilliant plan transitionally for people. And if you keep going in that direction, you'll find your set bar, your limbo bar that you have to crawl under, is going lower and lower. And then pretty soon you don't even want the stevia, mm-hmm. you know, because you don't have the internal craving. But yeah, people's cravings are super high, and your stevia and monk fruit is great. And I'll let you know this right now. Stevia is a therapeutic herb, and it does wonderful things for helping the cells balance blood sugar. So look at stevia as a great herb. And the fact that you can hit the sweet receptors with it and make life manageable. The stevia is beautiful, and I think so because I actually grow it in the garden. It was just killed by the Texas freeze. Wow. But I've been growing a stevia plant for many years, and goodbye stevia. It's one of nature's healing herbs. So anyway, Kelly, short question, long answer from Jack, but I hope you found some value in the background information.
All right. So next is David. David suffers from autoimmune psoriasis from leaky gut. He followed Plan P. He's on a second time around with gut thrive. His first time in October 29 was super successful, and he was almost completely clear of the psoriasis for a year. He's in week 5 of the second time around on Plan P. When he finishes, he was considered trying a vegan diet for 8 to 10 weeks to address long-term inflammation concerns, but wanted to do so carefully to not damage his gut again. He wants to use sprouted grains and lentils as a protein source, no soy, and limit lectin intake. Any thoughts or suggestions from a nutritionist perspective? You know, I would say, I don't know how you feel, Jack. I'm not a fan of just eliminating groups of things, you know, just because, like lectins and things like that. But what you might want to do, if you're able to, is run a food sensitivity panel on yourself, so you can actually see which foods are aggravating you or causing some type of inflammatory response in your body, so you can really fine tune it specifically to you. So that would be my suggestion. Do you have anything else to add, Jack?
Yeah, I'm going to give two sides of a coin here. Number one, I'm very much in favor from my studies of people doing like an 8 to 10 week vegan diet. It's a time to clean out excessive proteins from the body that might be acidifying the body and stuck in the wrong places. And it's just a way to really increase those phytonutrients from salads and lightly steamed vegetables and things like that. As we go, but when we look at this in light of the American diet, we're so over-amped on omega-6, and we have such a dearth now of omega-3. And this is a lot because so much of, whether it's a salad dressing or any product in the grocery store, it all has vegetable oil. And the issue with this is our cell membranes, the mitochondria membrane, that makes the ATP, the Golgi bodies, the endoplasmic reticuli. These are the organelles in your cells, as well as the cell membrane of the outer cell, the plasma membrane, that these all have a very delicate balance between omega-6 phospholipids and omega-3s. And if we don't have this balance somewhat regulated, we have trouble with energy, we have trouble with getting our minerals and our nutrients inside our cells. 8 to 10 weeks, call it a fast or a cleansing, but after 8 to 10 weeks, why not be looking at what do you do about omega-3? If you're, let's say, if you choose veganism, particularly, let's say, for religious reasons, I don't want to go up against anyone's religious beliefs, but you can get omega-3 from algae. And so there's algae omega-3 supplements, the EPA, DHAs, those are there on the market that you want to be a wise vegan and watch out for the B12 and the various things which B12 can be made from bacteria and be vegan. But you want to balance the weak links in that approach because ultimately your diet is determined by your genes. And a long history, like David, if you were East Indian and your ancestors have had a long 2,000 years of vegan diets, your systems work differently genetically due to epigenetics than someone who's just suddenly dropped it. So it's all things in perspective here, but I think that would be great to give it a try. But some of your best anti-inflammatories are already actually in the carnivore diet. It's the omega-3s that are in a grass-fed animal product. And if you're worried about animal products, then you're looking at wild-caught fish. And if you're worried about that, then you're going to algae or something. But you know, so we don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater, so to speak, on this. But a little cleanup and giving your digestion a break from all the protein can be a nice rest for a few weeks in this case. So you'll understand now, and at least in my studies, I've come to a position of a compromise, that it's both sides of the equation. We need some of this. A lot of the information that I find is coming from the Weston A. Price Foundation, $40 membership there, and you get all the data from the science and the idea that life on the farm, raising your food and the animals and so forth can be a beautiful way to nourish the body, and we need those fats and what our microbiome does. So it's balanced. You're all good to go, David. But after a while, you could actually have more inflammation on a vegan diet for the lack of some of the self-regulatory molecules.
Great. All right. Next is Heidi. Heidi had labs through her naturopath last week. Her estrogen spiked so high, it shows she's in her first trimester. Congratulations. That's awesome. Okay. Her blood sugar was 153 non-fasting. Her joints and her knees are filled with fluid. She's on plan H. She's in week 2 of the pathogen purge. I'm guessing my body's just resetting. Are you doing did you switch to the pregnancy protocol? That's my first question.
Because she may not be pregnant. It's just that her estrogen spike is high as if she was pregnant.
Oh, I misread it. I'm sorry. I'm not clear on if she, I thought she meant she was pregnant.
Yeah, okay. There's something going on with Heidi, that 153 fasting glucose is way.
If she's not pregnant and that's happening, then yeah, absolutely. She's got something going on. I would wonder if something, you should write in, Heidi, I can give you our carrot balancer recipe, and that helps if you do that before lunch, about 30 minutes. It can help bind to excess estrogen and get it out of the body. There are supplements like DIM, calcium deglucarate, that can be good. But I think I'd want to know a little bit more about what's going on with her, because that resting blood sugar is way too high. So Heidi, if you can write back in again and tell us more about it, because I misread it and I thought you meant you were pregnant.
Well, I think yeah, she needs to go to her naturopath and get a supplement that has the chromium and maybe bitter melon and and some of those things that science has proven
yeah.
will help drive some of that high glucose into the cells to be burnt,
yeah.
to be burnt up as making ATP and energy. But that's you need to retest pretty soon. I'm a little alarmed by the number there. And if it's a temporary spike and you're doing some house cleaning and flushing some stuff out, you're in the right place with the Gut Thrive, but you might want to check back with that naturopath and just get some extra coverage for these squeaky wheels that, yeah. that need a little bit of nurture and attention.
And some food frequency might help you with regulating the blood sugar. So make sure that you eat every 2.5 to 3 hours. That's going to help you. Like Jack said, some chromium picolinate would be super helpful for you. Maybe even a snack right before bed to help balance your hormones overnight would be beneficial. Something like a little golden milk, something like that would be good. But yeah, definitely you got to get those numbers down for sure. So, all right, Susan, should a person with SIBO do a course of antibiotics prior to GT5 or will GT5 take care of SIBO alone? Well, we can't give you medical advice and tell you what to do. That's something you have to decide for yourself. But we would say we have had great success at healing SIBO with our protocol, with the supplements, the salt flushes, the coffee enemas, the closing of the ileocecal valve. It's a super comprehensive approach. But again, that's a choice you have to make.
My opinion is we've built something better. One of the issues that lurks with rifaximin and some of the medications, while it's very similar strategy, right? The rifaximin is a pathogen purge, and then they give a prokinetic and these type of things within the medical model. But there is some lurking research that you knock out the SIBO with an antibiotic, and then the CFO starts to flare, that the yeast are there to pick up the niches. Well, this is already being addressed in the Gut Thrive because Krista's very aware that there can be a SIBO issue coupled with CFO and a segue there. And the beautiful thing about the plants, the plant or the herbal components is that they're not that distinguishing, and often the same herbs will ride herd on fungal forms and candida as well as bacteria. So I think the nature always gives us the best model first if we can pull it off. And so that's what you've got with this. Now, you might say, well, oh, gee, what I really meant was that I took the drug and I say that can work just great because you've already had a knockdown. Now you're coming back into a pathogen purge with a follow-up knockdown of pathogenic forms and you march right on out the other end. And you'll be using in the latter part of the program, you'll reestablish the hydrochloric acid and things that prevented SIBO in the first place. So unlike the drug motility support, Krista's program is, I think, actually more well thought out. She's going to double back to the top of the chain and work with your hydrochloric acid, your pepsin, your intrinsic factor, work it on down. And get you to break free. So if you took the medication, that's just fine. It's not a setback on anything. But I think you know you can put your trust and your expectations in your plan S and march forward.
All right. Next we have Judy. Judy's nearing the end of Gut Thrive. She plans to redo her GI MAP test to see if she cleared the parasite and H. pylori that were the impetus for her participating in the program. She wants to know how long she should wait after completing week 11 to redo the GI map and other labs that she might be interested to compare to her pre-program numbers. Well, I would say, you know, you still continue to do that terraforming and reseeding work for the next couple of months after you end the program. So it doesn't just stop at week 11, you're continuing to do that work. I would say to do the transition supplements, and then you could retest, I would say, 30, 60 days after, Jack?
Certainly. You want time so that what you read is your new reality. So the good lessons you've learned from Gut Thrive, if you're going to continue them, that's your new lifestyle. And you want it to have a couple of months to set in And when you go and redo your GI map, it's the reality of you. It's not altered by probiotics. It's not altered by prebiotics. It's what you are doing, and then it becomes your reality. You know, and you're not doing pathogen purging, and that's a good idea to get that veracity. Because if there was still a little H. pylori or a concern regarding a pathogenic form, it would immediately tell you to double back, and that your immune system has not yet learned to handle that and to keep those pathogens away. And then you want to come back and redouble your effort to go ahead and make that clean sweep. So, you know, it's information is power, and that's a good thing coming. But let's find out who you really are, not something that's being bolstered.
Okay, next is Jackie from earlier with the gallbladder flush. Just to be clear, Ultrafast followed by olive oil and enema is not considered a flush. Is it gentler? It is a little mini flush. So if you don't want to do that, you could just do the Ultrafast drops, and you can just do a lower dose over, say, a 30-day period. That would be a little gentle extra support for you instead of doing the full-on olive oil 3-day flush. All right, Monique, sorry if this has already come up. I have heard issues with Himalayan salt and heavy metal contamination. Any thoughts on this, Jack?
Get a good Himalayan salt. One of the things we have to kind of put into perspective is the Proposition 46 of California, which is a hyper sensitive registration. And the inside information is that it's a money grab by California and lawyers. And, you know, it takes an herb company at least $100,000 to get clear on that. The issue is that in any mineral from the earth, whether it's fulvic acid minerals, humates, things like that, the Himalayan salt, we're going to have all of nature's bounty, all the minerals in some small amount. If you just read the label on a bottle of Pellegrino, it's got aluminum in it, but it's a very minuscule amount, and it probably gives it some of its flavor. But aluminum is not good for the body, but it still is going to be in nature's water, and it's going to be in the foods, the whole foods that grow in nature. So look at where the standard is. If it's just flunking Prop 46, you want to look at the level of lead or something in it and see if it's within the nature's ratio of what's normal natural, or if there's something that there is a contaminated amount. Because anytime we see popularity of something, whether it's grapefruit seed extract or Himalayan salt, there's unscrupulous companies that want to give an inferior product and make the money that someone else earned by making a genuine product. So we've seen that with extra virgin olive oil, prosciutto. There's all kinds of things that balsamic vinegar, all these things have ended up being adulterated by unscrupulous. So be sure you check it and be sure to get a good company. Now, the thing is Krista does a lot of this investigation before. So when she makes the recommendations or you ask for the brands that can be sent to you by the whole journey, you're going to get products that are already vetted. But I thought we need to look at the standards here, and then you try to avoid the Himalayan salt that maybe they stuck the shovel down in the salt mine where there was less salt and more contaminants. And I'm sure that the money grabbing industry will try to do that. But you want to get back to a Himalayan salt, and I'm sure the reputable ones will give you the assay of all those minerals. Now, keep in mind, in salt deposits around the earth, they automatically have low levels of these types of contaminants that, in other words, if you were to say to a registered dietitian or a clinical nutritionist, I'm taking Himalaya salt because I want all the trace minerals. Well, I'm sorry, there's not that many trace minerals in there. There's a few. It's better than your salt that's mined, that's pure sodium chloride, and that has been heated and purified and altered and added a desiccant to it. You're getting back to a real old ancient sea salt, which is when the earth was covered in water. That's where these salt deposits come from. And so you just look at the assay, but you're really doing the Himalayan salt for the virtues of salt. And your cells need salt. Your intracellular processes need sodium, and which is why a low salt diet can be so devastating for some people. Mm-hmm. And you need the potassium, and you need more potassium than sodium outside the cells. So when we understand this, the Himalayan salt is not your major source of changing your life over trace minerals. It's about having salt that's viable, that hadn't been heat altered and manipulated. It's about getting nature's real salt to your body, and then your body's innate intelligence will start to break it up and use the chlorides for digestion and the sodium inside the cells, outside the cells, and those trace minerals keep it balanced. And because that is nature's balance. And in sea salt, we get the same, we get the ocean's ratios. So hopefully that can clarify that maybe in the Himalayan salt, it's a little bit over touted about all the trace minerals, but they're there, they serve a purpose, and they need to be in your salt. And now you can get the benefit. So get good, clean Himalayan salt.
Okay. And let's see.
Well, Monique is asking again about stevia, and the thing on stevia, you know, as I said, you have your plant in your garden if it didn't freeze to death, and then you have the extracts. Now, historically, the stevia extracts will taste like licorice. They have a bitter aftertaste, so they keep refining and refining, trying to get to that pure amino acid. And so we have to acknowledge if we have that big of a sweet tooth, we're using a stopgap product. And yeah, that white stevia, it comes in little sugar packets you tear open and put in your tea and you use in baking. That's just a much, much better substitute for using refined cane sugar or GMO beet sugar. You know, so you're making a huge step forward, but stevia in the white powder is still a processed manufactured substance. It's just one that's a whole lot better. And later, when your limbo bar of sugar craving comes down, you'll use less of that. And then you might even want to grow a little stevia in a flower pot in your window, and you can work with the leaf and the herb itself.
Mm-hmm. Kelly says, thanks, Dr. Jack. She likes that you go in depth with your responses, as do we. David says, thank you. Heidi says she's not pregnant. Okay. So then definitely circle back with your naturopath. We got to run those labs again. And send in a ticket to us, and we can give you some strategies to help you with that excess estrogen and balancing your blood glucose levels throughout the day, because that's going to help you significantly. Kelly wants to know, what supplements do you recommend if you're traveling internationally post-gut thrive? I would say I would definitely take a probiotic, and I would take that food sensitivity support with you, because you're going to be eating maybe in some restaurants, different places, different foods, maybe you're not as used to. So I would do that in case you get accidentally hit with some gluten, some dairy, whatever it is. And maybe some digestive enzymes to help you out. So, Jack.
Yeah, because your circadian rhythms are off, right? Yeah. You're jet lagged, and the sun is coming up at a different time. This throws your digestion off. So having a digestive aid will help. It ensures the hydrochloric acid. So as you get a new, I'm sorry, I just got all choked up. I was so excited. you need the hydrochloric acid in the digestive aid just to keep the bacteria in line, because your other cultural foods are going to have other bacterial species. And so probiotic keeps what you're used to strong in your GI tract and can counter even a food. You know, in Texas, we have something that we laugh about called the turista. And that means a Texan goes to Mexico and gets diarrhea, but we don't talk so much about the reciprocal. The Mexican comes to the US and gets diarrhea too. They get a turista because it's different cultures in the GI tract. So your probiotic keeps your you're steady, what you're accustomed to in balance. Then your digestive aid boosts with that meal what you need anyway. And then the only other thing I would take would just be your array of herbs to treat yourself if you get feeling fluish or intestinal disturbance. You want to have your good things that, you know, things like, you know, your golden seal or echinacea based products, things that can help you maintain so you don't have a sick day while you're out enjoying the you know, the canals of Venice or something and having food right from the, on the sidewalk and all the wonderful things you'll do traveling. So be safe and have fun.
All right.
And if you have trouble, I'll make a house call because I'm, I haven't traveled in yeah, way too long.
I know,
long.
Right? I'm so excited to travel again. Okay. So Michelle says she tested positive for candida. Her functional doctor gave her a script for fluconazole. Should she take this while doing the program and are there harmful side effects? So I wonder where you are, what stage of the program that you're in, but and also how long the script is for. I would rather you didn't take it. Well, in the, I would rather you take it before the pathogen purge, if that's possible. I don't know what stage you're in the program, but whether or not to take it is up to you. We can certainly handle and address candida and other fungal infections without it. And anytime you take an antibiotic, it's going to disrupt your microbiome a bit. And so we want to make sure that we get in right after that and take care of that. So I think it'd be more helpful if you tell us what part of the program that you're in. But you can, it's your choice whether or not to take the medication.
And you should read the side effects of fluconazole because it's devastating to the liver.
Yes.
And it's, I understand you've got candida, they're going to do that. So you want to make the best of that. We're not here to second guess or even have an opinion on what your doctor is doing, but you're taking a pathogen purge.
Yeah.
And so if there's a time or place to do that, it would probably be during the pathogen purge. And you really shouldn't be too far on the other side of the pathogen purge and have not resolved this issue. This issue may not be in the GI tract. It may be vaginal candida as well. And the same person who marked these private, of course, so I'm not going to use the name. These are... you got to go with your doctor because that's what your doctor has recommended and that's what you've chosen to do. So the script is for every day for a week and then once a week for three more weeks. I would personally just put that into the pathogen purge and say, well, it's all a blessing that you're going to have a systemic anti-yeast fungus influence. You've got the desiccated liver to help protect your liver. Okay, the message has just come through that the candida's in the blood. Now, I wonder if that's the case because that's pretty advanced and it's pretty sick to have your immune system is geared up and your body does not allow candida to flow through the blood. But we know it does, and we know then that's a breakdown. So your choice is to use the medication, put yourself back into the pathogen purge. If you agree, Nicole, wherever you are in the program, get into the pathogen purge. You can do both and have the gentle pathogen purge process. Hit it just like this. Don't worry about the one time, one dose a week for 3 weeks. I would simply do a 4 week pathogen purge. Mm-hmm. Line up your products. March through this, get on the other side of this candida issue. And the beauty of your gut thrive work is now you're coming in, you're going to have the probiotics to reseed. If you're with me on this, Nicole, I recommend you get on the probiotic right now.
That's what I was just going to say. I think she should put it in and do it 2 to 3 hours away from when she takes the medication, just so that we can kind of disrupt that.
Good research shows that taking the probiotics, even during antibiotics, or in this case, an antifungal, that it helps. It does make a difference. And so
I would have her add in a different one, though. What about having her add in some orthobiotic during the pathogen purge, you know?
Sure, so, sure. Yeah. And,
yeah.
And anything to lend a little support on the plus side. And so this person, I will call her M. I think your mission here is you're doing your medication, do 4 weeks of the pathogen purge. You're going to have such a brilliant clean sweep. And then the gut thrive is going to take care of you to reseed, recolonize, close the leaky gut, which unfortunately the drug won't do, and all the other things that are needed that are neglected by the medical model in their heroic efforts to give you a scorched earth policy and just kill everything. You're going to have the more, even a more rational approach where now you can rebuild and work your way on through the program. You should come out just marvelous from this.
Yeah, and I just put a link to Orthobiotic up above so you can see that, the one that we're talking about. All right, Jack, we've got a minute left and we have a few questions. Do you want to stay on a couple minutes extra? Do you have time, or should we just pick one last one?
Well, I think Jackie is concerned about the nightshades, and I'm trying to think what product has nightshade. Sometimes we have to look for odd things,
yeah,
such as goji berry.
Goji, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that type of thing. So you would just want to look at the products. And if you're a nightshade triggers an immune reaction, the fact that you have that involved with a serious autoimmune disease, your immune system's not going to turn that off on a dime.
Yep.
So you want to adhere to the dietary plan. Yes, start your supplements one at a time. Be sure you're stepping easy. The last thing you want is a flare-up.
Yeah, and I think she's talking about food, too, after she finishes the program. I would say if you're going to add food back in, you do it one at a time. You eat that food in a small amount. So say it's a potato, a white potato. Just take a tablespoon of it. You do it alone from other foods. You do it once a day. And if you don't have a reaction, you repeat it for 3 days in a row. If you don't have any kind of symptoms that you notice from it, then you can move on to the next thing. But I would do it in isolation one at a time so you can identify the things that are bothering you. So
yeah, and keep a pedal down on healing the gut, and let's break out that gut RA connection. I'm enthralled with some gut research that shows if you have a certain species in the gut, a certain species vaginally, and a certain species on the skin, that RA people have that constellation, like some 60%. This is fabulous research, but now you're looking at why not take the next step? Why not look at topical skin probiotics, which are just now entering the marketplace? Look at maintaining after this program several months where you really get strong, and see if you can't start doing more and more reversal of the overactive immunity towards your joints and come out and have a major benefit from this program.
All right. Let's see. I think we covered everything. It's now 1 o'clock. So we thank everyone for joining us today. We're super happy to be here and love connecting with you in this way. And we will see you at the next quarterly webinar. I think it's in June. And as always, Jack, thank you so much. And we'll see you soon. Bye, everyone.